Exploring the debate between science and religion. This is Seeking Truth, Science, Mystery, and Human Identity from St. Paul's Cathedral.
Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to St. Paul's Cathedral. It's great to see so many of you on such a cold and now wet night. I'm Claire Foster. I'm a lay canon at St. Paul's and a senior advisor to St. Paul's Institute. I'll introduce our distinguished panelists in a moment, but for those of you who are wondering, I'm sorry to say that Robert Winston has been called abroad on urgent government business and sends his apologies that he cannot be here. However, we are delighted to welcome Professor Dennis Noble, the renowned biologist, to the panel, a noble replacement, if I may say so. For those of you who have not been to one of our debates before, let me explain the format. In a moment, I'm going to ask each of our speakers to an opening question, and they'll speak for a few moments, and then we'll move into a panel discussion. Then for the last part of the evening, we'll take questions from the floor. If you have a question, please write it on the back of your leaflet and hold it right up to be collected. And there are people watching to see questions being held up. We'll be collecting questions until about 7:20, so please do write them down before then. Also, please try and keep them brief, because if they're long, they may not get asked. We'll end promptly at 8, but before you leave, please do visit the bookstall at the back. And please also give generously to the retiring collection for our education department. You'll have been given a gift aid envelope on the way in. Please fill it in and put your donation in it. There's other information about this evening and the whole programme in your white leaflets, including how you can hear a recording of it on Premier Radio this weekend, and also get a transcript, if you'd like, from our website. If you'd like to find out more about this series, please fill in the form in the leaflet and hand it in at the retiring collection or when you submit a question. We can also keep you informed about future events as well by this means. If you could fill in the feedback form too, we'd be very grateful. We really do read them all very carefully and use your suggestions to improve future events. I'd like also to take this opportunity to thank the Templeton Foundation for their generous sponsorship of this programme. It gives me great pleasure now to introduce our panel. Starting at my far right, Keith Ward is Emeritus Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford University, Professor of Divinity at Gresham College, London, and a priest in the Church of England. He is a prolific author, and his books include The Big Questions in Science and Religion, Why There Almost Certainly Is a God, and In Defense of the Soul. Neva Heites is a professor of medical genetics at the University of Aberdeen and an honorary consultant clinical geneticist at Aberdeen Royal Infirmary. Among numerous national and international roles on medical and scientific bodies, she serves on the Clinical Genetics Committee of the Royal College of Physicians. Neva also counsels those with a genetic disposition to cancer. John Polkinghorne was Professor of Mathematical Physics at Cambridge University and played a significant role in the discovery of the quark. He left to train as a priest in the Church of England, and after some years in parish ministry, he now combines ministry and academia. His many books include Quarks, Chaos and Christianity, and The Faith of a Physicist. Dennis Noble is Emeritus Professor of Cardiovascular Physiology at the University of Oxford and a world-renowned biologist. His latest book, The Music of Life, Biology Beyond the Genome, asks what life actually is and draws on his experience of researching the heartbeat, as well as on evolutionary biology, medicine, philosophy, linguistics, and Chinese culture. Would you please welcome our panel? So, Professor Noble Dennis, we often think about human beings as body, mind, and soul. Is that what a human being is? Is that how you think of yourself?
The answer is a resounding yes, but I hasten to add that the body, the mind, the soul, the self, spirit, or whatever you want to call it, are not objects in the same sense as each other. And I have two reasons for saying that, and the one comes from my experience as a biologist. You know, the body, you can touch it, you can feel it, you can even weigh it, but you certainly can't do that with the mind or the soul. And that has led some scientists, some of my colleagues, including very distinguished scientists like Francis Crick, the Nobel Prize winner, to question whether we should indeed be referring to the mind or the soul. You, he says in one of his books, your joys and your sorrows, your sense of yourself, your free will, are nothing more than the activity of billions of nerve cells and the associated molecules, which I would call the reductionist creed. And my experience as a biologist runs totally counter to that particular view. It is that the more you study the biological systems, the more you see the higher levels of organization as being processes rather than objects. And I would therefore suggest that the way to think of the mind or the soul is indeed as a process rather than as an object. But I also come at this from a personal viewpoint too. When I meditate, I might look at a candle flame, I might think of the sound of a bell and focus on that initially. And of course, in that process of meditating, you slowly remove all the activities of the mind, the thinking, the intentions, and so on. And I find, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this, that the further I go down that process of that kind of meditation, the more I find that there's absolutely nothing at the center. This, of course, is the Buddhist concept of no self. But that does not mean that the self does not exist. It certainly doesn't mean that the mind doesn't exist. It exists in a totally different sense. So I would say, yes, they exist, but that they are processes, whereas the body is a thing.
Thank you very much indeed. Nivahate, Heiti, how important are our genes in determining who we are?
Thanks very much, Claire. I'm going to try to interpret Claire's question by trying to look at some of the evidence around what makes us human and what makes each of us different from the person next to us. That is, unless you're an identical twin here tonight. With the sequencing of the human genome, that is, that the DNA, the inheritance material, or the recipes of life that are found in our cells, we're beginning to be able to look at the differences between a human and animal genomes. And from that evidence of the differences, we're beginning to be able to understand a little bit about how we have diverged from some of the animals. So if we think of chimps, we know that we diverged approximately 6 million years ago, and that we are approximately 98% identical to the chimp genome in terms of the human genome. And in comparison, the rhesus monkey, which we diverged from about 25 million years ago, were only 93% identical. But that's still probably quite a surprising amount of identity. Our human genome is about 3 billion chemicals long, or base pairs as we call them. And that is the recipes that give us about 25 to 20,000 different protein types that are produced from recipes. And when we look at the proteins that are different between a human and a chimp, we see that, in fact, on average, there's only two of the subunits of a protein, an amino acid, that are different between a chimp and a human. And if we look at a third of the proteins, a third of them are actually identical. So it's very interesting, this type of comparative genetics. But let's focus down and think about individuals. What's the difference between individuals, regardless of their background or their ethnic origins? In fact, we're 99.9% identical. 0.1% difference. And that 0.1% is made up, however, of 5 million of those chemicals, those base pairs. So again, we can start to look at those differences and see what that does to make us individuals. Now, one of the ways we could do this is to look at some of the things we know are very different about certain individuals. For example, some of the conditions that we see as illness or as being quite different in terms of structure and function. So if we think of a colleague with Down syndrome, we know that that individual, in general, is born with one extra recipe book or chromosome, chromosome 21, where they have three copies instead of two. And because they have this extra set of recipes producing an extra set of protein products, we know that causes some very typical effects to them in the way they live their lives and their disease risks. Perhaps of more relevance in terms of individual differences is what I've come across as a clinical geneticist, whereas the first family I ever dealt with as a senior clinical geneticist was a family with four generations of a history of ovarian and breast cancer. And I became very fond of that family, and I know them very well. I visited them often at births, and I visited them at weddings. And what was interesting was that although about half of the women had suffered from ovarian cancer or breast cancer, each of them took the same message from me in a very individual way. What they shared was a misprint in the gene called BRCA1, but what they presented to me was an individual point of view, as well as obviously a holistic, whole body set of criteria that were different one from the other. And that family taught me a great deal about the difference between genetics and the total individual. But we're now starting to begin to look at what makes an individual different. And if we think of something very simple, our sense of smell, we know there are lots of genes that code for things that affect our sense of smell. And we looked at 26 of them, scientists did. They looked at 190 people and they sequenced those 26 genes. And they found that there were unique combinations of misprints in those genes that were unique to 178 of the people. Now, those misprints were subtle ones. They didn't cause major predispositions or illness. They just changed the way people interpreted smell and their sensitivity to certain smells. Now, that's an example of where subtle changes can define individuality. And we see similar subtle changes in taste and in vision and in all of the different aspects of the way we relate with our environment, which are related to very subtle differences in our genome, which are incorporated into those 5 million that are different from one individual to the next.
Thank you very much indeed. Fascinating. John Polkinghorne, how might genetics inform theology?
I think that every significant scientific discovery informs theology by helping it to understand a bit more about the potential with which creation has been endowed and the processes by which that potential becomes an actuality. And I think that genetics helps theology by pointing in the direction of a very important concept, which is the concept of information. I think that we are just beginning in science to be able to study complex systems, only moderately complex systems, in their totality. It's not taking them to pieces, studying the exchange of energy between constituents, but taking them as a whole. When we do that, we find that these systems have an amazing power spontaneously to organize very complicated patterns of behavior. And the way to describe those patterns is in something like a concept of information rather than simply in terms of energy. Now, DNA represents a static form of information. It's the given, if you like, blueprint for the body, but it doesn't determine by any means the whole embodied being. We have 100,000 million neurons in our brains, which have 100 trillion connections between them at the very least. that amazing complexity could not be coded for by 30,000 genes. So a lot of the structure that's us, a lot of the pattern that's us, is produced through experience. It's produced epigenetically, as people say. And I think these sort of considerations help us a little bit to think about the problem of what is the real me, what is the human soul. When I talk about the soul, I'm talking about really what is the carrier of my identity, what is the real me. I mean, here am I, an elderly, bald academic. What makes me the same as the schoolboy with a shock of black hair in the school photograph of many years ago? It's tempting, of course, to say material continuity, but that's an illusion, because we know that the matter that makes up our bodies, the atoms that make up our bodies, are changing all the time through wear and tear, eating and drinking. I am atomically distinct from that schoolboy. What makes me the same, I think, which is a carrier of continuity, is not the matter, but the almost infinitely complex information-bearing pattern in which that matter is organized at any particular time. Now, of course, I'm waving my hands when I say that. I don't know, haven't the slightest idea how to describe accurately that fantastically complicated pattern. But that, I think, is the real me. That, I think, is the soul. It's a dynamic thing. My soul is formed as my memories accumulate, as my character is formed. It's also not wholly contained within my skin. I think part of the pattern that is me is the pattern of relationships that I have with other people around about me. So it's an immensely complicated thing to think about. But that, I think, is what the soul is. And of course, if that's, and incidentally, that's a revival in a sort of modern dress of really quite an ancient idea. Both Aristotle and following Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, thought of the soul as the form of the body. And I think what I'm saying is has a cousinly relationship to that. Now, if that's right, of course, the pattern that is me will decay with my death. But I think it's a perfectly, so it has no natural immortality. It's not a detachable spiritual component. I'm not an apprentice angel, I'm an embodied being. But I think it's a perfectly coherent belief, a belief that I entertain, that God will not allow, the faithful God will not allow the pattern that is me to be lost. It will be held in divine memory. That isn't quite me continuing a full human life. I have to be embodied by that. But the Christian hope, of course, is that God will re-embody that pattern that is me in some great final act of resurrection. So that's a long way from DNA, but these things hold together, it seems to me. I think these are fruitful and, to me, helpful analogies.
Thank you very much indeed. And Keith Ward, finally. A Judeo-Christian understanding of human beings is that we are made in the image of God. What does that mean to you?
Well, I suppose since I've been a professor of theology, I ought to start with the Bible and start with Genesis. And a lot of people think that the Christian or the Jewish view of the soul is that it's quite a separate bit, a substance, which is separate from the body, quite different from it, and might even be better off without it. So I'd just like to say that's not the biblical view at all. And I think a lot of the modern discoveries in biology about DNA help to make more profound our understanding of the human person as a physical being of a certain complexity and a very distinctive nature. So the first thing I'd say is that there's no word for soul anywhere in the Bible. But, of course, you might find the word soul in some translations, but there's no actual word for it. The nearest thing in the Hebrew, in Genesis, is the word nefesh. And that does indeed mean principle of life, but it's important to notice that all living things, all animals, even vegetables, potatoes and tomatoes, have souls. So they all have living principles. So having a soul, for the Bible, isn't what makes human beings special. And indeed, as Claire mentioned, it's the notion of being created in the image of God that makes human beings special. So what is it to be created in the image of God? First of all, again, what it's not It is not being physically like God in any way at all. Nothing physical is like God. But many people have thought it means, well, we have some mental characteristics like God's. We might be free, we're able to understand, we're able to think, and those characteristics may be a bit like God. And that might be true and important, but it's not what most scholars now would think being made in the image of God really points to. And the general opinion now amongst Old Testament biblical scholars is that being made in the image of God is having the role of God, under God, of course, with respect to creation. So just as God creates and cares for creation, so human beings are distinctive among all the animals on the earth because we are able, we have the capacity to understand creation and to care for it too. We're responsible for how it goes. So being made in the image of God is having capacities which make it possible for us to care for or, unfortunately, to destroy the earth. And it's having those capacities which make human beings special. And that notion of capacity, of course, echoes what Professor Porkinghorne said about Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas is probably the greatest of all Christian philosophers. And he, in fact, did say the soul is the form of the body. Now, there could be lots of discussion about what exactly that means. But what it doesn't mean is that the soul is quite different and attached contingently to the body. That means the soul is the set of capacities that a human being, that a person has. It is what makes some animal a person as opposed to not quite a person. And personal capacities, I suppose to put it briefly, are those which have a unique point of view, a perspective on a growing, developing experience, and a certain control over their future, however small, so that they make free choices which make their future their own. So persons are animals, persons are embodied, and I think the expression process is quite a good word for a capacity of a body. And that might leave the question, well, what happens at death if we are such that our souls are principles which enable us to have certain capacities in the body, can they continue beyond the death of the body? And actually, I think that that is a possibility. That is to say, the same process, the same pattern, the same set of memories, the same projects and ideals, the things that we've made of our life can be re-embodied in a different form. And I suppose that is what the key text in the New Testament says in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, that there will be a resurrection body as different from this physical body as the wheat is from the seed. It'll be a different form. Perhaps we wouldn't even call it material in that it meets the second law of thermodynamics and decays away, but there'll be some form in which the soul, the capacities of a person, their memories, their projects, their ideals, can be embodied in a social reality. I think that's the Christian view. So what's distinctive about it is that we believe that our personalities, though they're fully physically based, can transcend this piece of matter, even this material universe, and be re-embodied in a grander world where the presence of God will be clearer and more intense. That, I think, is and ought to be the traditional Jewish and Christian view of the soul, I think.
Thank you very much. So I've just had a note here. Make sure speakers speak close to the microphone. It's really in your face, this microphone. Is this sounding all right as I speak? And also, please speak a little slower. That's for all of us. And can I remind you, please do write your questions down, because there'll come a point when it's too late. Write your questions down and hold them up really clearly like that. I just want to ask you, Keith, as a matter of clarification for me, and perhaps I missed something in what you said. We were talking about
human beings in the image of God, and you were speaking about the nature of a person and that which transcends the physical and indeed goes on after death. Can you relate that description to the idea of the image of God, or humans in the image of God, more clearly for us?
Well, I think the idea of the image of God is related to our responsibility for ourselves, for other people, and for the planet. So being made in the image of God is having a functional responsibility. It's not anything that you can pin down to a particular substantial form.
Image of God is a duty.
It's a responsibility. It's a privilege. And certainly, I think if you say what's different about human beings from other animals, then what is most obviously different is that we can understand the mathematical structure of the universe, and we can build machines which help to change the universe. So our responsibility is in this universe. It would be a great mistake, I think, to think of the soul as something which only exists after death, or which has its most important part after death. It's got a responsibility and a privilege in this embodied world. I think we're probably all agreed that that would be true if there were a soul.
John.
Well, I entirely agree that being the image of God carries a responsibility for caring for God's creation. I think it also probably offers an opportunity. I think that human beings have, no doubt, faint and fitful, but nevertheless real and undeniable power to be aware of the divine presence, to be aware of the divine will. And I think that is part of what is meant by the bestowal of the divine image upon us. So I'd want to see it as a sort of two-way transaction, so to speak, that we have a responsibility, of course, to the creation of which we're part, that we're aided in that responsibility by a relationship with the one who is the creator of that world.
Neva.
I guess I'd just like to add there that I think regardless of our creed or religious beliefs, we all have that responsibility for the planet as a human being. And it's good to have it attached to something that is firmly held by you, but I don't think that negates the responsibility of other people for our planet and for their interhuman relationships. So I suppose in a context of a scientist, I think about it more in terms of the way the brain and the body functions as a whole, because even the concept of the spirit, the soul and the mind comes because we have a brain that can think, as John was telling us. The complexity of that brain allows us to consider these concepts as possibilities. But I think regardless of the way we interpret that intelligence that we have, we continue to have responsibilities that are far broader than just our domestic day-to-day ones.
Thank you. Anything to add? No. Now, I'd like to put together something you said, Dennis, about the soul and the mind being more process than entity, with John's account of the pattern created, as you put it, epigenetically. Do you think, perhaps Dennis, you would answer first, then John, that you're talking about the same thing?
Well, process is, after all, pattern in time. So the answer, I think, is clearly yes. And I'm sure John doesn't want to exclude time from the dimension in which we can look at the patterns or processes that we're talking about. But the other thing to say on this is that processes obviously require the physical structure on which they are based. That's the sense in which, of course, the brain is totally necessary for us to have consciousness, to be a self in the first place. But you know, there's a remarkable degree to which the causality, if I might put it that way, can go the other way. Let me tell you one experiment that was done last year by a group of scientists in Canada. They were studying the stroking behavior in rats as they groom their young. And if there are no predators around, they do that. They stroke their young, they lick them. Motherly love, if you like, and certainly a form of expression of their kind of mentality, their soul, if you wish. Now, if you bring those colonies of rats up in a context in which there are predators, they don't do that. They don't have the time to do so. They're defending the nest. Now, that activity is inherited. Question is how? Is it just that they're copying, just as we might copy culturally what our parents did? The answer is no. The great surprise of this experiment is that it's done epigenetically. The stroking behavior itself marks the right region of the brain, the hippocampus, which underlies the stroking behavior itself, which is astonishing. So there can be causality going the other way. I refer to this in my book as downward causation, and we're finding examples of this all over the place as the field of epigenetics grows and grows.
Well, I certainly agree that processes, that's why I spoke of the soul, as I understand it, as being a dynamical thing, something that grows and develops and so on, and that's very, very much the so I'd agree about that. I'd just like to make a comment about the relation of the brain to all this. I mean, obviously, we need brains to be human persons. If I hit you on the head with a hammer, it will certainly not improve your human experiences. On the other hand, we should resist the temptation to thinking that our experience as persons, our consciousness, for example, is simply a sort of froth, an epiphenomenon, as people like to say, of purely physical processes taking place within the brain. If you don't have the processes, you won't have the experiences, but it seems to me that the relationship between them is more subtle than that. Neuroscience at the moment is making wonderful discoveries about how, for example, visual input is processed in the brain. And we should take all that seriously and gratefully. But there is currently an enormously unbridged, yawning gap between that kind of talk, valuable though it is, and our simplest personal experiences of seeing red or feeling hungry. We just don't know how to make that bridge across. I don't rejoice in ignorance, but equally I don't think the way to deal with ignorance is to leave aside half of the experience.
Thank you. Neva, do you want to say something about epigenetics? Perhaps defining the word for us first.
I think I'll give you an example in humans that is parallel to the one Keith's mentioning, which is that we now know that the embryo brought up in the mother's womb is very much influenced by the mother's diet and other activities of the mother. And we're able to actually identify chemical changes in parts of the DNA, which are these epigenetic changes, where a chemical change can actually switch on a gene or off a gene or modify the expression of a gene. So an epigenetic change is an added-on effect on your inherited genetics, which is caused by the body, but clearly that has an environmental influence. And so when you do studies, for example, of birth cohorts that have been under different circumstances, perhaps as in China, been in famine as compared to in the West, been in excess of availability of food, we're now being able to correlate outcomes in terms of mental health issues. And it's clear that some of the cohorts that were in the famine in China are in fact much more susceptible to certain forms of mental disorders, including schizophrenia. And it's almost for certain, and we're now defining the epigenetic changes and the genes that are changed by those influences based on those dietary effects. So we're really starting now to begin to be able to correlate chemical and clinical effects based on environmental influences.
Well, that's very interesting. It just indicates that these patterns and processes are subject to change even at a genetic level. Keith, do you want to add anything?
Well, I'll just add one thing, because I didn't speak about God before, and I was rightly told off for that. And, of course, God would be, for most of us, a consciousness with knowledge and with intention. And yet God is not a physical being in any sense. So I think for a religious believer, one has to have the concept of a being which is not at all physical, but has consciousness, knowledge, and intention. So in a sense, the destiny of the soul for a person who believes that God is the ultimate reality is to be united to God and to be aware of God. So while it's entirely true that finite consciousness of human beings depends on the brain, I think, as Dennis said, it doesn't wholly depend. Consciousness can also have effects on the physical brain and obviously on the environment. So that perhaps when we talk of spirit in the Christian way of talking, body, soul and spirit, or body, mind and spirit, we're thinking of that part of a human being which relates to a wholly unembodied consciousness which lies at the root of reality. And I think for a religious view, that's a very important part of soul, that it does relate to something beyond the material, even though the soul is very dependent on its own material embodiment.
Thank you. I'd like to go back now to a point that a few of you have raised about the what we might call the personal experience or the individual experience, which is really, one might say, utterly unique, and try and put that together with the idea that individuality might ultimately be explained by genetics. And what I suppose what I want to ask is whether there's something about the scientific method that can't reach that interior, individual, personal, unrepeatable experience that we all have. I wonder who'd like to pick that up first. John, then Dennis.
Yes, I think science is amazingly successful, but because it concentrates on a particular kind of experience, essentially reality encountered as an it, if you like, as an object, and in that domain, because it's reduced to the sort of common denominator of objective experience, you can do the same thing over and over again, and that gives science its great secret weapon, which is the weapon of experiment. I'm a theoretical physicist, but my subject has been largely driven by experimental discoveries. Now, there's a whole swathe of human experience between ourselves, our encounters with beauty, our intuitions of ethical imperative, that aren't subject to repetition in that sort of way. We never hear the same piece of music the same way twice, even if we play the same disc again. And science, I think, is unable, just by its own self-restriction, to deal with repeatable experience, which is most of the experience that makes personal life valuable and worth living.
I would just put the point in a slightly different way, but I think I agree with you, John, that science is not history. And to the extent that we as persons, the mind that we are, the soul that we are, is dependent upon our own individual histories and our history of interactions with everybody else, here again I think we come to the interaction side of all of this, it's exceedingly difficult to see how science can deal with that. I mean, that's why we have other disciplines that do deal with that. They're called the social sciences, I suppose. That's a form of science in the sense of knowledge. But the question I think you're going for is science in the sense of the standard Anglo-Saxon method of doing empirical discovery. And it's extremely difficult to see how a process that relies on being able to repeat, to determine that you really have found the truth about a matter, physically and empirically, can deal with relationships and interactions that are essentially history dependent. That's the problem.
Thank you. Yes, Neva. Yes, I mean, it is quite remarkable, really, that there's such a small percentage of genetic difference, and yet we are so unutterably different from each other, and our experience of life is so different.
Yes. If I would say this, I am a scientist, and I guess our ability to answer some of the questions is because we haven't yet been able to establish exactly the question we're trying to ask or the tools that we need to answer the questions. And when you were talking about emotions and feelings, I was thinking about the way we all feel about our children, our own child. There's that little feeling inside of you when you think of your own child. And much as you love other children, it's different. It's slightly different. And there was a psychology experiment I was thinking of that was performed using magnetic resonance imaging, a way of imaging the brain and looking at how it's functioning. And it told people who were being scanned that this basket contains your goods that you got at the supermarket, and this contains somebody else's. And they took away in the person's mind, they said to them, I'm taking away an apple out of the red basket, which is your basket. And the person's brain expressed in the MRI a certain activity pattern. And they then took an orange out of the green basket, which was your neighbor's basket, and a completely different part of the brain showed activity, demonstrating that there are ways by which our brain does actually influence the way we are interpreting quite subtle differences about what we regard as ours and we regard as somebody else's. And I know that's not a perfect analogy, but it is a little indication of the types of work we're now able to do with these powerful imaging techniques in looking at how the brain quite subtly differentiates between feelings that we are having.
So, John, do you think is it just a matter of there being different science or better science that can somehow reach to these experiences which make life valuable that are personal, or is it not a matter for science at all?
I still remain rather unrepentant, saying that science has purchased its great success by the modesty of its ambition. I mean, what we've been told about are very interesting results, and they correspond to the undoubted fact, that we are embodied beings. For example, people also found that when Buddhist monks or Carmelite nuns meditate, particular parts of the brain light up. That's very interesting, but it doesn't tell us anything about what that experience is in terms of value and authenticity. When I think about physics, no doubt bits of my brain light up. That doesn't tell me anything about the nature of physical understanding. So of course we're embodied, and of course it's good to know how these things happen. But there's more to aesthetic delight, for example, than the shift in the balance of neurotransmitters, I think.
Perhaps it doesn't want to be asked too many questions or analysed too greatly. Do you want to come back, Neva or Keith, say anything?
Well, I think C.B. Snow, many years ago, talked about the two cultures, the culture of science and the culture, not even of the social sciences, but of the humanities. And I think there's still a hint of that here. And that I would think that science does deal with what is quantifiable, what you can measure, what everybody can observe, and what you can repeat. And I don't think that an understanding of what it is to be a human being, to have the unique experiences that you have, and to work out the meaning and point of your own life for yourself, I don't think those are scientific activities. It's rather like analyzing a piece of music in terms of the wavelengths of sound that it consists of. It's interesting to see that it consists of those wavelengths, but you're not really learning how to appreciate Beethoven by doing that. So there's the interiority of a person is of immense significance. Your morality, your moral attitudes, your point of view, how you relate to other people. And I don't believe there will ever be a scientific answer to questions about what ought I to do. It's a different sort of question. So the science is invaluable for finding out the limits of what you could do, but then you've got to go on to questions of your own personal experience, and the place to find that is in novels rather than in textbooks.
Stories. I'm just going to push this one step further and then we'll move on. Supposing, though, Neva in her work was I know it's not what you do, but the geneticist was able to say, well, you might think that you've made a moral decision and you might think that you've developed an appreciation of music, but actually all of that can be explained by your genes, by your DNA. We haven't discovered that yet, but we will eventually. Keith.
You're asking me? Oh, sorry.
Dennis has got an answer first,
all right.
You want to think about it.
Well, yes, this is one of the difficult questions, isn't it? I actually don't see the genome as a program for life. that's one of the metaphors that I take in my book in order to, as it were, disentangle it and say that I think that has led us to precisely that kind of question. And I think it's the wrong kind of question, because what is clearly emerging in modern biology is that there is extensive interaction between the genome as a kind of organ of the body and the rest of both the body and the environment. And so I would say that's really to put the question in the wrong sense. In my book, I give an example of an action that I did while I was writing the book. And the action was that, as somebody asked a question while I was writing away, I just pointed. I didn't say anything. And then I imagine a physiologist, I am a physiologist, so I can easily imagine this, working out all the neural connections that are involved in doing that. And he writes his paper up and he says, I have analyzed the neurophysiological basis of the action of pointing. Then a philosopher comes up to him and says, hey, wait a minute, you haven't analyzed an action at all, and I'll prove it to you. What I will do is the following experiment. I will use you as the subject, and I will put electrodes on your brain to stimulate the nerve cells in exactly the way you describe. Now tell me what happens. Now, of course, we know there are ethical problems with doing that experiment, but this is a thought experiment, so we don't have to worry about the ethics. What happens? The poor man does that, and he says, I didn't do it. You made me do it. Now, the reason is very simple. The reason that I did that was that somebody asked me where the lead was to take the dog out for a walk. And without knowing that, without knowing those interactions with other people, you don't analyze the phenomenon. If you analyze it totally inside here, the phenomenon just doesn't exist.
John.
Just make a very quick comment. When I hear these claims of the unlimited explanatory power of science, I remember particularly a celebrated pioneer of quantum theory, Wolfgang Pauli, who had a very sharp tongue, and he used to wag his finger at people and say, no credits for the future. In other words, don't claim that next year we're going to explain everything. Get ahead and explain it.
Thank you. Neva, I slightly feel I should let you reply.
I feel we sound as if we're further apart than we probably are. We're talking about extremely complex issues. And I'll just remind ourselves of another experiment which was carried out in the 60s and 70s, and it was looking at twins in Minnesota who'd actually been reared apart. And I think they had just over 70 sets of twins, and about 35 of them were identical, and the rest were non-identical twins. And they looked at those twins. Now, they'd been reared in very, very different environments, the identical twins, and they looked to see what influence where they were reared had and their monozygosity, their identicalness, had on their tendency to be religious. And they found that there was much, much greater agreement in identical twins about their tendency to either be or not be religious as compared to the non-identical twins, which suggested that it wasn't environment that was influencing that so much as the fact that they actually shared their genome. Now, that's not the total story. And anecdotally, I was telling Claire, I have two friends who have identical siblings. One is a Jewish family background and the other is a Church of Scotland family background. One of the Jewish family background's brother is a rabbi and the other is an atheist. They're identical twins. And the same for the Church of Scotland. One is deeply committed and the other is an atheist. Now, in other words, these experiments don't necessarily prove anything. The Mistral study in the 1960s was strongly suggestive there's an influence, but clearly, as I've given as two little case histories, there are other things which influenced your beliefs and the way you perceive the world and the unknown and conceptualize it for yourself based on incidents that have occurred personally close to you and based on how your education has led you, I think, in different directions. So I think we're not as far apart as it may sound.
Thank you. Keith, any final thought on this?
Well, I just make this comment that there are colleagues of mine in Oxford, though I can't recall their names at the moment, who have said that religious beliefs are caused by some disturbance or virus in the brain of some sort. And of course, it's also true that atheist beliefs are caused by whatever goes on in the brain. And the point is this, whatever you say goes on in the brain, that research is not going to answer the question, which of those views is true? Is there a God or isn't there? Nothing that you do to the brain will tell you which is true, but it's a real question. So there's at least one question which science can never answer in principle of any part of our life. Which of your beliefs is true? Science will tell you what causes the belief, perhaps, possibly. It will give you a part cause, a necessary cause. But it will not answer the question, is it true? And I think there's a simple question that science can never answer. Though some scientists assume that their own beliefs are true, strangely enough.
Thank you very much.
I must be the only person in this room who doesn't know who he's talking about.
Well, I'm certainly not going to say. Okay, one more thing. There's some excellent questions here. There's just one more thing I want to touch on, touch being the salient word here. We've talked about the soul as being non-physical, but what do we understand by the suggestions that souls might touch or be touched?
Shall I have Dennis. A go at that? I didn't fully answer your first question, you see, Claire, because I think you wanted me also to say something about body, mind, and soul. I think that question enables us to at least start to draw a distinction between mind and soul, because if you ask the question, can you touch a soul, I said earlier on, you can't. Obviously, in the sense that you can touch a body, you can't. You can't touch a mind either. But metaphorically, we do speak like this. If I speak of the dark night of the soul, you all know that I'm referring to somebody who is grieving or is in some other kind of very, very severe distress. And we do not mean the dark night of the mind. That would make one think of somebody puzzling over something, a difficult scientific problem, or maybe a puzzle in the newspaper. It doesn't carry the same weight. So I would say you can touch, but you're using the word touch there metaphorically. But that's not to denigrate it. Most of our language, after all, is metaphorical.
Thank you. John?
Well, I just want to say that I think there's much more relationality around in the world than sometimes we are able to recognize. Even in physics, even in my old branch of physics, particle physics, we know that the subatomic world cannot be treated atomistically because of quantum entanglement. So I think there's a lot of rationality around. I'm not saying therefore souls can touch, that would be an absurd argument, but I think at every level of human experience it is likely that there is more connection than we are aware of, and particularly more than we are aware of in our highly individualistic age, where we tend to think of ourselves as isolated beings.
Keith?
I think that in prayer, religious believers do aim at or hope for an experience of the soul touching God, and that it wouldn't be surprising if in touching God you touched those souls who were also touching God. And in that sense, there might be a deep significance in the expression the communion of saints, of communion of that part of the personality which, arising from the physical, transcends it without ever leaving it entirely, but transfigures it into something of spiritual depth. And then you might say that a person has a deep soul, if you're speaking about the fact that they can appreciate things that are beyond easy description. And a touching of souls perhaps is an ideal concept for prayer.
Anything, Neva?
This is a very serious discussion. I'm not trying to trivialize it, but I'm trying to compare what you're describing with other situations, such as the girl and the boy, their eyes meet across the room and they both feel something that's very special, and they come together and their relationship begins. I think we are, as human beings, able to have fairly special feelings that appear to transcend distance, etc. Many of you will have had the experience of you go to ring your child and the phone rings and it's your child on the phone ringing you. Again, you have that feeling that somehow you've connected just prior to that happening. So while respecting what you're saying, I think there probably are comparative but less deeply meaningful examples of where we can touch each other in a very significant way.
I don't think that trivialises it at all. I think it's another demonstration of the same point. Well, let's ask, there's some fantastic questions here. The first one on the list is, what happens to the soul in dementia? John.
Well, I'll jump in where angels fear to tread. It's, of course, a very distressing experience to see someone who is demented, and you have the feeling that person somehow has gone. I think that the soul, so to speak, has been trapped internally and is not lost, but is unable to find forms of outward expression. That's the best I can do, but I certainly don't think, I don't think that person has disappeared, though they may have disappeared from our view.
Do you use the word soul and the word person interchangeably?
Well, I tend to, because as I said in my little opening remarks, I think of the soul as being the real me, and therefore the centre of my personhood.
Keith?
Well, I would have thought it's very important to think that persons change a lot. And you respect them for what you have known them to be, and you respect them as they grow and as they fade. And so preserving that respect is deeply important, whether you're religious or not, because it's the whole story of a life that's important, not just one stage. When somebody's asleep, you may say, well, they're not conscious, you know, they're not doing anything, but you know that actually that's part of a richer life. If you do have a religious belief, then of course you think that God will bring that soul into being at its fullest range of capacities, so that dementia is an incapacitation which will, in the presence of God, be overcome. But either way, I think you can think, if you think of the person as a whole, as related to the society in which they have grown and lived, then it's important to continue those sorts of relationships and to remember them as whole persons throughout a whole series of stages of life, and not just the one stage they happen to be in.
Including the relationality you were speaking about earlier, John. Anything new?
No, I think Keith has captured that very well. I can appreciate what he's saying. And thinking of demented close family as well as patients that I've known, some of them retain that wonderful essence of the type of person they were. And although cognitively they are functioning very poorly, you can still see a compassionate, kind person there, as they were. Now, others, unfortunately, can go another way and show a bad nature, a very aggressive nature. And I think for the observer, it's much more difficult to conceive of that wonderful person that you knew before when that type of dementia occurs. And I was just thinking, as you were saying that, what do we think about the soul of a terrible person, of a person who has caused anarchy or a psychopath? Where do we think of their soul? And I can't answer that, but that's what I was interested in thinking about, other than dementia, with other ways of behaviour, how has the soul been modified?
Nothing. Well, there's a question here that follows on from that, which is evil part of the body or part of the soul? Neither does matter. Dennis.
I have a very quick answer. You cannot make an attribute like evil apply to the parts of my body. It's as simple as that.
I agree. I think the body, it's another interesting difference between the body alone and the embodied person. The body is something you can view dispassionately, almost mechanically, really. You can do that. But of course, if you're doing that, you're not regarding it as the body of a person. So it's the personal aspect which makes the difference, and that's the aspect of what a person has done with their life and how they experience their life. Evil, I think it is possible for somebody to turn away from good, to turn away from love, sadly. But I think the Christian gospel is that it's never too late, and God always offers the possibility of turning back. I think that is good news.
Do you want to add anything, John? I'm just thinking about a body being shot through with all that the person is and whether they're distinguishable.
But if we take this dynamical view of the soul, then of course it can grow in a distorted way or in a fulfilling way. But of course I agree with Keith that I don't think that the distortions and corruptions are beyond healing. But it may be a painful process for that to happen. In fact, it will be.
Neva?
I find it a very difficult concept. If you think of a mental illness, say schizophrenia, that you can treat and you can return the person to a behaviour pattern that we consider more consistent with society, I'm not sure what we've done to the spirit in that body, to the soul, as such, whereas I know what we're doing to the brain. And I suppose that there will come a day when we'll understand more about evil and the behaviour that is out with what we consider parameters that are normal within society. And my perception is that there will come a time when we'll be able to actually define that in quite clear terms and see it as either an environmental influence or an influence that has come from within that person, and which has generated a form of behaviour that is not acceptable.
Thank you. There's a question here I want to ask. It picks up on this internal-external aspect of our existences and experience, which is this: when the Bible is taken as a manual of truth, doesn't that inhibit our own discovery of the soul and self? Aren't we better guided by the inner self? Keith?
I don't quite understand that. What is the inner self? Is that our own intuitions about what we are?
Not an external manual telling you what you should believe about yourself, I think.
Well, I don't think the Bible is that, anyway. The Bible is not a manual for anything. Please don't believe that. The Bible is a way in which God may speak to someone who reads it in faith. But it doesn't give you information. If you wanted information, I'd look elsewhere.
Including about your soul?
Well, the Bible, you see, as I said, doesn't talk about the soul. It talks about responsibilities. It talks about moral obligations. It talks about justice. You know, let justice flourish let it roll like a stream. It talks about your obligations. And I think this is where I have a slight hesitation about saying, oh, well, one day we'll see that if people are evil, it's because something in their brain is causing them to be. Well, insofar as that's true, and I think this is why Jesus said, don't judge, that you never know when something is being caused by something physical in the brain. But I'd want to really hang on to the view that people in the end have responsibility. And that responsibility is, again, something, you know, science can't deal with. You can't answer the question, are people free and responsible? A scientist can never answer that. As a matter of fact, a philosopher can't either. But we still use that. We call people responsible. So I think it's very important to hang on to that element of responsibility. And I think the Bible helps you to acknowledge your responsibility and what it is that you ought to be doing for the good of the world. But it doesn't. It's not a manual which lays down specific rules that you have to follow in every circumstance. There's just one I might follow in every circumstance, which is love your neighbour as yourself. And love God, perhaps, too. Yes, sorry.
Thank you. Yes, John.
I agree with that. I think the great mistake to see the Bible, or indeed any form of sacred literature, as a textbook, is much more a laboratory manual in which are recorded the insights and spiritual experiences that will be illuminating to us.
No. Neither.
It's difficult when you're not imbibed with a study of a document such as this. And I'm well aware that there are other documents of equal status for other religions. And there are some consistent messages that come out from the Quran and the other good books. And I see them, therefore, as more an evolutionary tendency in our understanding of our relationship with the world and with mankind, and almost good practice guidelines developing. For me, the Bible was written in its time. It was written by a group of men. There were very few women who actually contributed in a major way. And therefore, I see it as a point in history, rather, I think, than the firm basis which perhaps you're speaking about it. But my level of knowledge is not great enough.
Thank you very much for that contribution. Yes, this is picking up on something you alluded to, Keith, about the soul and the spirit. And there's a question here. How do you distinguish between the soul and the spirit? Is there a difference? Perhaps you'd like to answer that, and then others can pick it up.
Well, in the New Testament, Paul talks about body, soul, and spirit. The word soul is psuche, so you could just call that mind, psychological capacities, really. And then spirit is that part of the mind which relates you to God, specifically. So the spirit, and the word is breath, is the breath of God. So that it's at the heart of each human being, there is actually the presence of God as a breathing, vivifying, life-giving principle. So under three-form unity for the Bible. So you've got the body, you've got the capacities, mental capacities of understanding and appreciating and acting freely. And then you've got the presence of God within. And that's the spirit, really, I think.
So do all sentient beings have spirit?
Yes.
Including animals?
Yes. Every living thing has the breath of life, which is the spirit. Yeah.
Thank you. Dennis?
Well, I think all I want to add to that is to say that different cultural traditions, and particularly different religious traditions, tend to divide up these entities in very, very different ways. Suffice it to say that if we were talking in the context of an East Asian audience, we would draw these lines somewhat differently. I don't find that surprising, and I don't think it's a problem either.
How differently would we draw them if this was an East Asian? Did you say Southeast Asian audience?
Well, I like the story, you know, that when the Buddhists went from India to China and they first started to convey to the Chinese this concept of the no-self, what I was referring to earlier on, what leads you to the view that the self is a process rather than a thing. The reaction of many Chinese was to say, why do you need to convince us of this? We never thought there was such a question. Now, the reason for that is that Taoism has exactly the same idea. And so even the question, like, is it a matter of distinguishing body and other things like mind and spirit, is treated differently in different languages and in different cultures. All I'm pleading for is that we recognize that. There are other ways of looking at it, but I don't think we should be bothered by that.
Neva or John, add anything? John?
Well, I just say that I've always found tripartite language very difficult to know how to understand and use. I mean, I tend to think that we are unitary beings with two complementary aspects, one of which you can label, if you like, bodily, the other you can label mental stroke spiritual. But to further subdivision that, I personally don't feel helpful, but that's a statement about me, perhaps, rather than about reality.
Yes, as a, again, developing that a little, there's a question here.
then could one argue that we are part of a larger process, a universal soul? A universal soul, could this be God?
That's a big question.
Keith.
Oh. I can only speak when I'm switched on. There are certainly religious views which would hold that we are all parts of God and that God is the oversoul of which we're all parts. Indeed, there are elements of the Christian faith and of Islam, but I won't go into that. There are elements of the Christian faith which speak about Christians living in Christ. And insofar as Christians say Christ is divine, then you're saying, well, human beings can be part of God. But I think most Christians, like me, would want to say, well, in the end, God could exist without us. But maybe I'd go so far as to say, maybe God would be different if we didn't exist. For a Christian, maybe there wouldn't be a cross and a resurrection, for example. So I think the world may make a difference to God.
Dennis, do you want to add anything? No.
I'll pass on this one. I am actually, despite a lot of the things I've said this evening, I'm a very non-metaphysical person.
I'm a very metaphysical person, and my wife keeps telling me to give it up.
Does it make you hard to understand? Is this really happening, or is it a metaphor? Did you want to add anything, John?
Well, I would just say that, personally, I think it is very important to maintain the distinction between creator and creation, not least because creation has an inbuilt transience to it, but I think has the hope of a destiny beyond its death. But that can only, I think, rest in a creator who is both faithful and not subject to transience and decay.
Neva.
Again, to comment, I think, about humans on this planet having a unified responsibility to each other and to the planetary system, the planet and its needs, I think is becoming clearer and clearer. And whatever you call that, unifying theory, I think it is something that is going to become essential to ensure that the ecosystem in which we live and that the variety of human ethnic backgrounds is maintained to continue to have the kind of planet that we've become accustomed to with all of its diversity that gives it such wonderful variety. And I would hope that regardless of one's background and religious views, that people will come to realize the importance of actually working together to achieve good health, good supplies and good approaches to the environment. And whatever we call it and however we define it, I think that's going to be something that for our children and particularly our children's children is of absolute importance.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, there's a question here taking us to a different place altogether. How does the panel view the argument for intelligent design? John.
Can I say unfavorably? I think that the intelligent design people have good intentions, but they make two very bad mistakes. They make a scientific mistake in thinking they can demonstrate, for example, irreducible complexity. Because they think you've got six pieces you need for this, you could only assemble it if those six pieces were immediately brought together. But evolution doesn't work that way. It's opportunistic. Two bits for this, two bits for that, fuse it together, and so on. I mean, there are people here who know much more about that than me, but that seems clear to me that they make a claim that if it were scientifically validated, it would be a remarkable discovery, but they haven't made it. But even more important, they make a bad theological mistake because they are looking for gaps. And though they are very careful in their public language for political reasons in the United States, of course they see God as the designer. And behind it lies a terribly bad theological mistake that if nature did it all, somehow or other God had nothing to do with it. But if God is the creator and sustainer of nature, God acts as much through natural process as any other way. And if you could show me, which of course you can't, but if you could show me that the whole story of life from the first replicating molecules to you and me was a totally natural process. That wouldn't mean that God hadn't done it. God's purpose wasn't behind it. So I'm afraid I'm not too keen on ID, as you perhaps will gather.
Keith?
What annoys me is that people in the press keep talking about intelligent design creationism. I think we have to be quite clear. Intelligent design is not creationism. Creationism is the view that the world was created in 6 days. Intelligent design people accept that evolution happened. But I agree with John about them. They haven't really convinced the community of biologists that there are things which need a designer to explain. But I'd just like to say this one thing. Of course, I don't think it's possible to say every little bit of the world, every bit of the human body or any animal body is specifically designed by anybody. That's not possible. But it is possible, I think, to say that the whole process of creation and evolution is intelligently designed. So it's very important to make that distinction, to say the process of evolution is, of course, intelligently designed. But unfortunately, the American movement called American design has stopped us using the expression intelligent design, because we don't want to say that God keeps interfering to make things happen that wouldn't otherwise happen. Right?
Can I make a stuttering interjection to say that I absolutely agree with Keith, and I deeply resent the hijacking of important words. We believe, Keith and I at least believe in intelligent design in the sense he's explained. I'm also a creationist. Not in the curious North American sense of the word, but because I believe the world to be God's creation. Useful words have been corrupted.
Doesn't design, though, imply a designer? I mean, one can accept intelligence, but design? You would say designer, wouldn't you?
I expect God did design the universe. I mean, I've got no problem with that. I tried using the expression intelligent creation, but that didn't work either. You just can't win this battle. People are determined to misunderstand it. You have to distinguish creationism, 6 day, no evolution, intelligent design, evolution, but with God doing special things every now and again that nature can't do, and intelligent creation, which is this whole universe and the way it's set up, shows immense ingenuity at the very least. And I think, for me, that belief is highly reasonable and doesn't involve what is now called the intelligent design hypothesis. You know, let science decide on that.
Dennis?
Just a brief comment. It seems to me that intelligence is a very, very difficult thing to define. Just think of all the arguments over intelligence tests, just to indicate. There are very, very many different forms of intelligence. The chapter in my little book that deals with evolution ends with the statement that evolution was more blind than Beethoven was deaf. But that doesn't mean to say that I don't think there is a particular kind of intelligence there. There is intelligence in the process by which the whole thing happened. And I tell you, although I'm a scientist and I investigate these phenomena in accordance with the standard laws of science and empirical discovery, I'm still amazed and in awe of what it is that we see around us.
We are drawing to the end of the evening, in that I'm going to ask the panel in a moment, each of you, to leave us with a thought. But let's just throw in one last question. Where is it? Priests are said to be given the cure of souls. What does this mean? We have two priests on the panel. Keith.
What it actually means in Elizabethan English is the care of people.
Yes. Exactly.
John.
Exactly. I entirely agree. Yes. Absolutely.
We've got time for one more question. Could a highly developed machine ever have a soul? Neva, you start.
We've spoken about the fact that we think all living beings have a soul, and we've spoken about the soul in the biblical sense as really being in a way the way the brain functions. And I know it's been spoken in other ways. Depending upon the intelligence of this particular robot, etc., I suppose it will have the ability to make some thoughts of its own as a computer. Will that be a soul? Well, in my terms, it will be demonstration of a function.